first tonight. On the line is Phil Nihay, General Secretary for the Irish Midwives and Nurses Organisation, which conducts a daily trolley count, 534 today. Phil Nihay, thanks for joining us. What does that figure look like on the ground, according to staff that you've been talking to?
Well, good evening, Colm. The figures are very high, obviously, for this time of the year, but I suppose I want to go back to the figures we produced at the end of July. So at the end of July this year, we raised an alarm because our figures that we count, as you say, on a daily basis were 52% higher than they had been in July 2021. And at that stage, we were saying, you know, these figures are way too high. We have to start working now towards preventing a twindemic this winter. So at that stage, just for the month of July alone, Limerick University Hospital Limerick had 1,268 patients. Cork University Hospital had 1,000. Galway had 998. St. Vincent's in Dublin had 692. Sligo 617. So the hospitals that continuously have been overcrowded and showing a very high number were like that in the middle of the summer. So I suppose the biggest issue for staff is they know that we've been raising it. We're their trade union. We count these on a daily basis. And the reason we count them is to raise alarm and to show trends and to say to the HSE and to the political system, look, looking at this trend, this is not going the right way.
What response did you get in July, or what was the level of engagement when you raised those concerns?
Well, very little, to be frank. I think there is usually a scurry of trying to discredit the figures. You'll have commentators coming out saying, oh, but the HSE count differently. You have all this over and back like tennis about the figures as opposed to about the underlying issues. So what we want as nurses working in these departments and as the representative of nurses is that when nurses who are frontline looking at this problem every day, apologising to patients, unfortunately now reporting the unenviable position of being the most assaulted healthcare workers, they want somebody to listen to them. And they want the management of the HSE and the political system to say, well, you know, we better start working here towards a winter plan. What we normally have is we have a winter plan that's produced towards the end of the year. Today, for example, the HSE are coming out saying, oh, you know, we didn't have enough beds open on New Year's Day. But sure, all of that is predictable.
And are the staff there? Could the staff have been put in place between July and now to have opened those beds? Or is the chronic staff shortage simply the thing that's getting in the way of opening those beds, like under any winter plan?
No, I think what should have been done is what was done in Waterford. What should have been done is we reached an agreement with the HSE in 2016 that when you go into full capacity protocol, in other words, you have trolleys up on your wards, you have patients for whom there are no beds, not just in your ED, but also on your wards, you take action immediately and you start what's termed de-escalation because you know now your hospital cannot function. We know that patients are not safe and hospitals are not operating safely if their capacity is over 85%. Our hospitals are constantly over 100%, and we're trying, you know, to dress up when we have 300 people on trolleys that's a good day. It's not a good day because it is not safe until your hospital reaches 85% capacity. That requires plans then, for example, much earlier than we're taking this year to get the private hospital beds capacity on board, just as we did at the beginning of COVID. It's exactly the same type of emergency and the same focus has to be brought to it. What's happening, unfortunately, is we're constantly crisis managing too late, planning too late, and then the staff who are working constantly now, remember that the winter of 2019 was very bad, straight into a pandemic where the staff who work in the front line had to turn the system around. Nurses who work in theatre had to go and retrain as ICU nurses. And all of that went on for the best part of 2 years. And now they're back into the same mess again.
And you mentioned Waterford there. I mean, why, in your estimation, is that regional variation there?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. But I think the main reason is when you have a capacity problem and you know you're going to have too many people for the service and the bed capacity that you have, you plan in advance, you look to your private hospitals, and you cancel all your electives. You can't provide two services when you don't have room. You can only provide one. And those are hard decisions. They are not popular decisions. But unfortunately, to keep patients safe, you have to make them. Because if you have patients waiting to be seen in accident in ED departments, or if you have patients on trolleys on wards, the research tells us their outcomes are poorer, and unfortunately, 1 in 82 of them don't make it. So those statistics are so bad that you can't excuse it away. You have to make sure that you prevent it.
And you would agree then with Dr. Matthew Sadler, the Consultants Committee of the IMO, then, would you, that lives have probably already been lost as a result of the delays caused by emergency department, the build-ups in emergency departments?
Well, I think there's a lot of research to confirm that point. And that's why I think it's fair to say that we have been highlighting through our trolley count that it is not good practice. To have patients on trolleys lessens their likelihood of having a good outcome. And sometimes we know this, and our frontline nurses say it all the time, particularly for our elderly people, when they are forced to be on trolleys in wards or on an emergency department where the lights are on, where you've no privacy, where your business is discussed within earshot of a lot of other people, your outcome is much poorer, but you lose your confidence. You come out of that 3 or 4 day stay on a trolley a much different person, not as confident.
And
nobody
just
wants that. And the people that I represent who work in those settings don't want that.
And on the issue of, I suppose, with the crowding comes the need for infection control, you've called for a mask mandate. The Taoiseach says that that's not currently considered. What's your reaction to that?
Well, again, I suppose I've had a lot of discussions with both the HSE and with the Minister this week. We've written to the CMO again. It's not really a matter other than to say when we're overcrowded to this level, we have to try and prevent people getting sick in the community. We know that masks work. We know that they're very simple. But we know that right now the public health advice has to be far stronger because unfortunately...
Can you understand why it's not far stronger?
I can't. I think it's a very simple measure. It's well proven. We know that if you wear a mask in congregated settings, the likelihood of transmission is reduced. None of the information we got about masks during COVID has changed, and it is now just simply a matter of our hospitals are overcrowded. Our staff are very tired. They're getting very exhausted from a constant exposure to this level of work, and a simple enough public health measure isn't being followed as rigorously as it needs to be. So therefore, we must consider mandating.
All right. We have a panel of politicians here with us this evening. So tell us, in your estimation, what political action is needed in the very near term to alleviate what's going on where you are?
I think we have to understand now that this problem is not going to go away before the end of February, at the very earliest. Therefore, we have to look at a national position around getting more beds. The only areas that we can look to in the short term is the private hospital, private acute hospitals. We have to make sure that hospitals are supported in cancelling electives and that the staff who are working in these departments are supported in a number of ways. We are currently pursuing a claim for nurses and other healthcare workers who are suffering from long COVID. We are being forced through an industrial relations mechanism going to the WRC to argue that that is a workplace injury. Now, if you were a staff member who had long COVID, who got that infection because of your employment, and that's the manner in which your issue is being dealt with by your employer, you lose faith very quickly, and your decision to leave becomes much stronger. We do not want nurses, doctors and other healthcare workers leaving the Irish Public Health Service. We desperately need them to stay.
Right. You've begun a consultation for industrial action. The circumstances your members are dealing with, do you think that makes support for industrial action more likely?
Well, I think that from the initial consultation we've had, which is with our national executive, who are all themselves working nurses and midwives, they don't see anybody listening to them. All of the warnings, all of the meetings, and still the planning is too late. So they're saying, why should we be expected to put up with this type of a workplace and also expose ourselves to ill health, expose ourselves to assault? There are responsibilities on employers. Right. And the minimum responsibility is to keep a worker safe when they go to work.
Okay, all right. Well, stay with us. You can hear what our panel has to say and maybe respond shortly. Priscilla Lynch, we're weeks into this. Is it improving in any way? Or has the worst yet to come, based on other years?
I suppose we're years into this, healthcare staff and patients would say. But yeah, I mean, last week, 931 patients and trolleys across the country. Like, that's a figure that we hope never to see again. But unfortunately, it is possible that it could happen because we haven't hit peak flu season yet. That's another 2 or 3 weeks away. And kind of we were hit hard and fast, but generally earlier than we normally would see such high figures in our hospital system. And as Finlay Hay pointed out there, a range of measures have been taken in the short term now to bring these numbers down, but they're still very they're unacceptable. And have we become kind of like, oh, it's only 500 now or 500 and something compared to, say, last week? You know, things are okay, but they're not okay. And it's not just as well the patients that are admitted who are waiting for beds. It's those who are attending as well and who need care desperately, who need to be assessed desperately. They're waiting very long time in emergency departments. I mean, there was about 28,000 attendances across our emergency departments last week, and less than 7,500 of those needed to be admitted. So, I mean, like, you know, we're not really talking about their experience either. And it's a very frightening time for parents as well of young children. And when we're seeing how overcrowded the children's hospitals are, you know, in the midst of this RSV surge and also strep A. So, you know, people are very concerned. And the fact that patients don't even want to come into hospital, particularly older, frailer patients, I mean, again, that's just very alarming.
Right. Colin Burke, to you first in our Cork studio. Your party, part of your platform when you were seeking election in 2011, and you've been in government that long, was a radical reform of the health service. You went to the country on that, and this is the state of the health service now as we enter 2023. How do you explain to people how that happened?
I think the big change that has happened in Ireland is that there's been a huge increase in population in a very short time period. Remember, when we went into government, we had 15% unemployment. We had 50,000 people a year leaving the country. We turned that around. You know, we set a target of creating 100,000 jobs. We've created 700,000. We now have a lot.
I know,
more
but
people.
Some of those jobs were created in the private sector. Exactly. In the area where you can recruit people, it seems, in places like the health service, the defence forces, the Gardaí, teaching. There's been less success there, you'd concede.
In the health services, we've gone from 103,000 people in December 2014 to over 136,000 now, which is whole-time equivalents. So there's been an increase of over 33,000 in the last, since 2014. Now, we still have huge challenges because we are not responding fast enough. Our health service is not responding fast enough in relation to the delivery of infrastructure. For instance, one of the things that I've been looking for in the Cork area for the last 5 years is about building a new elective hospital. And it took, for instance, when the proposal came in from the South Southwest Hospital Group to the Department of Health in January, it took from January to September before the Department of Health sent it down to the Office of Public Expenditure. That's not good enough. We've got to make sure.
With respect, you sound like you're involved in an organisation that has nothing to do with that. Your party is in government.
I've consistently looked for the growth in relation to the services, because you can't deliver a healthcare service if you don't have sufficient number of beds. And for instance, one of the other things that we have is the coordination in relation to services. For instance, Nursing Homes Ireland produced a survey this morning which showed that out of 147 nursing homes, there was 760 beds vacant. And I'm advised, having contacted a lot of nursing homes over the last 5 to 6 weeks, they've had very little contact from the HSE.
So what I'm hearing from you is demographics and poor management in the HSE and very little acceptance of responsibility of any government role in this.
No, I'm saying that we all have a responsibility, and we in government.
But what's your responsibility?
We have a responsibility, but it's about it's one thing producing a plan, it's making sure then when you devolve down as regards the implementation of that plan that it's actually delivered upon. And the best example of all is, you know, why did we have so many people who were, you know, where they had been signed out as ready for discharge from hospital, but still over 600 people were still inside in hospital, even though they were ready to leave the hospital? And why, for instance, and this is my big issue, is why does it take so long that once a consultant or a medical practitioner signs out that the person can go home,
You have been in government since 2011. If you don't know the answers to those questions by now, there's something seriously wrong, is
no,
there?
No, but what I'm saying is that we have set out quite clearly, there was a plan set out. The question is then, why wasn't it implemented? And in particular, why does it take so long to line
but
up
But why
people?
Are you, a government TD, asking that question? Why don't you know the answer to that
because
question
we've
when
raised
you have a direct
with,
line
I've
to the ministers and
the
HSE?
With both the minister and with the HSE as regards, you know, this is, we were going to face a huge challenge this year because we were going to have, when the numbers, if you look at the numbers last week, over 1,500 people in hospital as a result of flu and viruses and COVID. That's 1,500 people that normally might not be in hospital. The question is, then how do you free up beds in a timely manner? And that appears to have been a problem over the last 10 days.
We're going to go to the rest of our panel here. David Cullinan.
Well, first of all, a plan has to be implemented and a plan has to be enforced. That's the job of government, that's the job of the Minister for Health, and it's also the job of the HSE. Today we had 534 people on trolleys, and almost some in the media and some in the HSE were breathing a sigh of relief. Well, 534 is not as bad as almost 1,000 last week. It's still a massive figure. 534 is well above where we were last year. And it's masked somewhat by the fact that we're seeing cancellation of elective procedures, so day beds are being used as inpatient beds. And that's a trade-off that's been used now right across the state. Philney Hay talked about the Waterford model, which is working reasonably well, where very quick, rapid decisions are made.
But that involves cancellation of elective surgery.
That's my point. That's my point. But here's what we need to do. We need a much better collaboration between public hospitals and private hospitals so that more elective work can be done in private hospitals. But there's a number of things we need to do. The first is to start in the hospitals. We know we need more beds. And the time to start planning for this summer, because we had a summer trolley crisis this year, and the time to start planning for next year is right now. It takes time to open beds, as we know. So the time for that has to start right now over the next number of weeks. Through modular units, it can be done very quickly. So we need more beds. We also need more consultants, more nurses, more doctors.
That's not going to be done in the short term, is
it? And here's the problem. The big failure is in workforce planning. And that's the most comprehensive response we need from the Minister for Health. There is no joined up approach between the Minister for Health, the Minister for Higher Education. Right. We have to substantially ratchet up training places. Yes, elective-only hospitals will help to ensure that we don't have that clash between scheduled and unscheduled care. They're some time away. But the other critical issue is what's happening outside of our hospitals. We have to invest in step-down and recovery beds to speed up discharges, but we also need to make sure that people have alternative care pathways in terms of vetivers, GP care, community pharmacy, all of those options. What we're seeing at the moment is none of that working, and it all converges in your emergency departments. And final point, if I can, is safe staffing levels. And Philney Hay and the INMO have been talking about this for a long time. We know what the science is.
We need to implement it.
Yeah, look, just to pick up on some of the points there that David made, which I agree with, we haven't heard from Simon Harris here, the Minister for Higher Education. What plans have been put in place for increased training places to come on stream this September and subsequent September, so we're actually producing the healthcare workers we need? What about the Department of Justice? We know that work permits are very slow to be processed in terms of healthcare workers that are looking to come to work to the country right now. Healthcare workers at all levels that can be delivered in the short term. We're not hearing anything from the minister. So when we talk about a whole government response and we're talking about things that can be done now, there are things that can be done now. But look, there's a very simple calculation in this country that we're always falling short of. We have 3 hospital beds per 1,000 head of population. The international average is 5. We're miles away from that. We shouldn't be just going for the average. We should be trying to exceed the average. We are like so far behind on that, and there's no planning to say how we're actually going to deliver those beds. To get back to Deputy Burke, who's defending just in terms of the elective hospitals, Sláinte Care is calling for 6 elective hospitals in total. There's 2 in planning at the moment. But in my own constituency, we had a Minister for Health in James Riley, who, when he finished advocating for a primary care centre for sores that he didn't deliver, spent years advocating for what he called the day hospital for sores for South Fingal, which would have been a private elective hospital, purely private, which would have charged the state. Ultimately, it was never delivered. But this is where the political energy of a Minister for Health, who continued to be a senior figure in Fine Gael in government, that's where the political energies went. So that's when you're talking about what the government priorities are and where senior government figures have been focusing their energy in terms of health. Right. That's one example.
All right.
And nothing was delivered.
All right.
Public or indifferent.
All right, we'll come back to Philney Hay, who's been listening to all of this. Have you heard anything, Philney Hay, there that would encourage you that at least there is some solution on the way?
Well, I think the recruitment and retention, as has been said, we've been highlighting this. Like, there is good news in this. We have a framework now, which is government policy, which is the first time ever in Ireland that we have a tool that tells us what is the correct number of nurses to have on a medical ward, on a surgical ward, in an ED. And right now, the research is being done in long-term care and older person services and the community services. So that's good news. We know now. We have the measurement tool. The problem is we have never funded it to the level that we need to. So our members are saying that if they went on duty tonight, for example, we know that in many of our hospitals tonight, nurses will go on to wards where the staffing level isn't correct. They'll have responsibility for over 10, 11, 12, and in sometimes if there are trolleys on that ward, that'll go up to maybe 15 or 16 patients. And our population is much older now, and we have a lot of comorbidities, so people are sicker when they come to hospital. The reason they're admitted, and the reason, obviously we're talking about not having beds, but the reason that they're sick enough to be in hospital is because they're sick. And you then have a situation where you don't have sufficient staff to look after them. So the framework is good news. It tells us, the research shows that when you staff wards better, patients get their medication on time, patients get their treatment much earlier, their outcomes are better, the staff stay in those wards, and you save money because you reduce agency. So all of that is good news. It makes no sense to us why the government hasn't fully got behind it, fully funded it, and said, before we do anything else next year in next year's budget, we'll fully fund that, and we'll set about a recruitment plan to make sure we can staff to the level that we know is safe, that we know will save us money, and that will keep our staff that we're training in this country working in this country. Right. We need to increase our undergraduate places. We need to increase them significantly. So more nurses being trained. And again, there's good news there. School leavers, there are more school leavers opting for nursing than places available. And we need to make more places available in the public system. And all of those things are there to be done, but they require a very strong direction and investment from government.
All right. Just before we go, we're going to take a quick break shortly, but Colin Burke, do you want to respond to some of that criticism of government before we go to that break?
Well, as I said, we've had a huge increase in population over a very short time period. In respect of delivering services, we appear... Our whole system seems to be reacting too slowly as regards putting the infrastructure in place. And I am saying that this is something that we have to expedite and deliver on. For instance, you know, the elective hospitals...
And we as in the government, is it?
But it's a part of government, but it's also part of the system where, you know, as I said, two government departments...
But is the government not part of the system? But I mean, when you talk of the system, it's something separate.
A government department 10 months to pass down information about...
But the government department is headed by a minister.
It is, exactly. But that's the point why I kept raising this matter in the Dáil and about keep pushing in relation to delivery of the elective hospitals.
Sounds like no confidence to me.
We're going to get further medical opinion. We'll go to that short break now.
Text 51551. The Late Debate on RTE Radio 1.
Right, well, we heard from Philly Hay from the INMO, the Nurses Union, at the top of the programme. We're joined on the line now by Dr. Chris Luke, former consultant in emergency medicine at Cork University Hospital. Chris Luke, good evening to you.
Good evening, Colm.
We heard from the Irish Medical Organisation's Consultant Committee Chairman that there's a very real likelihood that some patients would have died as a result of avoidable delays in the health system in recent weeks. You'd presumably agree with that, would you?
I'm afraid I do. I mean, we have been conscious of avoidable deaths in the emergency departments of Australia and the UK and Ireland over the last 10, 15 years, and the evidence is becoming stronger and stronger. People who are listening, for example, to the NHS crisis, which is not much different from ours, will hear really fairly alarming figures being advanced of up to 500 deaths a week being suggested as a result of their emergency department and ambulance dysfunction. We suggest in Ireland, usually the rule of thumb is 400 or 500 a year, or 400 anyway, deaths that are avoidable due to our ED dysfunction. And I'm afraid that those numbers may escalate with current crisis.
Right. And you've said this is as acute, you've written in the Irish Examiner, this is as acute as the pandemic. And that would suggest that a much greater effort is needed to tackle the current crisis, is it?
Well, I mean, Colm, I was a consultant for 30 years clinically. And, you know, the crisis, the so-called crisis, has been going on for at least 25 years. You know, we've had problems with ambulances queuing up outside EDs for at least 25 years. We've had people on trolleys, as far as the eye can see, for at least 25 years. Now, I'll accept that it was more intermittent in the 90s and then in the noughties. Now it is perennial, it's permanent. And in fact, I don't really...
So how much is money and how much is demographics and how much is poor management in your estimation?
Well, all of them have a role. I mean, we have an ageing population. We have a growing population, as Colin Burke suggested. We have an ageing population of general practitioners, you know, many of whom are on the brink or have just retired and are about to retire. We are really struggling to keep up with that population expansion. And as far as I'm aware, we have fewer beds this year than we did 20, 25 years ago.
This suggestion of suspending elective work as an emergency measure until the waiting time outside emergency departments is open, does that not ultimately push those people who are in need of elective surgery onto an emergency list, but just further down the line?
Yes, and the problem is that over the last 25 years, we have steadily eliminated the alternatives to emergency emergency department access. Emergency departments are now basically the only practical portal of entry into the health system for public patients who are waiting for years on waiting lists for scans or consultant appointments, and as well as the homeless, the addicted, people with chronic diseases, and people who can't increasingly get hold of a GP or even get onto a GP's list. So unfortunately, we've eliminated so many options that the situation is now dire, where we have the elective and the emergency functions of most hospitals in direct conflict with each other, competing, for example, for the porters in the hospital, competing for space, competing for beds, and so on. And I have to say, having worked in the NHS for 14 years, I am a fan of standalone elective hospitals, because that's the only way, I think, that you'll stop having this endless conflict between the emergency and the elective.
With the NHS is a very different system to the system run by the HSE, and yet you say the issues are the same. How is there such commonality between two such different systems, finally?
Well, I don't think they're very different at all. I mean, on the ground, they're the same model. We have the same, you know, Anglo-Irish, Anglo-American model of emergency departments, which are, you know, basically free at the point of delivery, or, you know, they're a modest sum. And they all have the same sort of population, with the same sort of cohort of patients, whether you're in New York or whether you're in, you know, Birmingham or whether you're in Cork. It's the same type of medical population and the same sort of type of practices. As far as I'm concerned, the real issue here is leadership. And I'm afraid that for the duration of the current crisis, we have got to reorient our hospitals corporately to face the front and to face the crisis. And I'd expect the most senior management of every hospital to be present in the emergency department for as long as it is overwhelmed, quote unquote, every day.
All right, Chris Luke, thanks very much for joining us. David Cullinan, you've been talking to healthcare staff as well, maybe not quite accessing hospitals, but talking to staff around the country. That issue of the management, the systemic issue, the need to change around responsibilities, what are you hearing back from individual hospitals who are looking at other hospitals like your own local one, and I'm wondering perhaps why their hospital isn't working the same way?
Well, I think the fundamental difference in Waterford is that the hospital management are brave and can make very quick, rapid decisions. It's obviously a very difficult choice to have to cancel elective procedures, and that has consequences for patients and also for waiting lists in those hospitals. But I think when you're in the throes of a real crisis in emergency departments, and when you know the cavalry is not coming, there's no additional beds or staff going to come in a matter of weeks. When you have a surge in demand in emergency departments, you have to prioritise, redeploy staff. And I think hospitals are now looking at that and making decisions quickly or more quicker. But There's also a very good relationship between the hospital management in Waterford and community health organisations and the management of the community services. So one of the advantages of Sláintecare, and one of the things that we need to see happen very quickly, is that realignment to regional health areas, integrate healthcare, not have multiple layers of management where you have community services, primary care services managed differently and acute hospitals managed differently. You have one budget in an area, one tier of management, and they can decide where priorities need to be.
But one of the challenges to Sláintecare is we've seen the need for private hospitals potentially for the medium term, at least, at the very least, to provide surge capacity. Does that present an obstacle to Sláintecare if private hospitals are needed on such a regular basis going forward?
I don't believe so, because if Sláintecare was implemented quicker than it has been, we'd have those elective hospitals already in place, the public ones. We also, and what Sláintecare talked about, which is really important, is about community care, because we're talking a lot about hospitals. We know we need more beds, we need more surge theatre capacity, more diagnostic capacity, all of that slows down the time, or I suppose it creates longer time frames for people in hospitals. What's as important as all of that hospital capacity which is needed is the step down and recovery beds in the community, GP care, out of hours care, all of that. That was a key part of Sláintecare, most of which simply wasn't delivered.
Priscilla Lynch, why is there such a regional variation in the approach? I mean, it has been commented that some of it's as much almost personality and practice in Waterford as anything else. Is there a systemic issue there that has thrown this up, or is it actually some areas of the country, like the Midwest, are dealing with different resource issues?
I think it's both, really. There is certainly a reluctance to implement full capacity protocols in some of the hospitals.
And why?
It is difficult to try and stop elective surgery, and there's a lot of competing interests in the hospitals. I mean, they're all advocating for the best outcomes for their patients, but it can be difficult in the bigger hospitals with multi-specialties, and particularly in Dublin. So does the HSE need to step in and actually give the order when we have numbers like this, just actually to get on and do it and to take more of a cohesive approach? It's also complex as well, according to the different regions. Like Limerick has a particular problem because Ennis and Nina, they were essentially downgraded.
They were the first to go in terms of the small hospital plan, weren't
well,
they?
Well, the North East as well have particular issues there. And what keeps happening is that they might change the smaller hospitals not to take in these patients in emergency departments, but then they don't resource the bigger hospitals to actually deal with the increase in patients. So Limerick has had an increase in population. It has to take from the population surrounding it, from the smaller hospitals as well. And also, it doesn't have the private capacity in the Midwest. I mean, we have a lot of private hospitals up in Dublin, even in Galway, and Galway is still in trouble as well, actually, regularly. So there are a number of particular issues. It's also on the population that is in the particular hospital. And we have seen an increase in older patients, in particular those over 75, an increase of about 15% in those coming to our emergency departments in the last number of years. But as we've all heard tonight, there is solutions. We do know what the problems are, and they were predictable to a large degree. And to be fair to the HSE, it has taken some of the measures that we have discussed here tonight, but not, you know, too little too late, I think, is the accusation. There isn't really, I suppose, kind of the drive there to really implement that change. And it's not easy to implement change, we have to admit. But there are solutions there, and other countries have really grasped the mettle and they've actually done it.
And at that intersection between politics, the Department of Health, the HSE, can further pressure be put on, or where does the responsibility lie? Colin Burke, we heard him, we'll come back to him shortly. We've heard him say things need to be done and questions need to be answered. But who can answer those questions in your estimation?
Well, we've had a lot of change as well in the HSE in the last year. If you look at who were the healthcare leaders during the COVID-19 pandemic, they've all gone. We lost the chief medical officer and the deputy chief medical officer in the Department of Health. Now, there has been replacements, but there's always going to be a transition period. We lost the CEO of the HSE as well, Paul Reid, and O'Connor as well, his deputy. And again, that's kind of a transition process. So people have stepped up. But has the eye, you know, have we had the focus on the crisis that we should have had? Really, all the healthcare unions say that we haven't, you know, that they knew what was going to happen. And this solution, again, of trying to take people in last weekend, you know, more senior people across the basis, not just consultants, but all the support staff that they actually need so that they can discharge patients, that has worked to a certain degree. They have been able to discharge more. Could we put in that? Could we put in a set incentives that every January to the middle of February, that they do put forward a special plan to ask healthcare staff, more of them, to come in, perhaps pay them extra fees to cover that? Because because there is higher absenteeism as well in January, so it's always going to be fairly chaotic. And things do slow down naturally over Christmas. Can we try and put the mechanisms in place that things get up and running much quicker in January? And that also applies to community services and to nursing home beds and to those beds being available for patients. So yes, we have seen a huge spike in respiratory illness, and any healthcare system will struggle to deal with that. But again, because we're operating at such, you know, high capacity levels in our hospitals, we just simply don't have the capacity. And that's the one, if people said, what is the one answer to our healthcare crisis? It is capacity. We just have that mismatch between population and what we do need. And it's not just about beds, to be fair, the HSE has pointed that out. They are trying to make other ways of patients getting care, such as direct scan referral by GPs. That is working quite well, because otherwise patients have to go directly to emergency departments and queue overnight just to get a scan. But now that they can refer directly. So there are other solutions.
Duncan Smith, your party was in government as well between 2011 and 2016. Can you point to a significant improvement in this situation that your party made during that time that shows you do have the ideas to change this?
Well, look, we had a trolley crisis then, and we had actually a higher bed per 1,000 capita ratio in 2016 when we left government than we do now. We actually were keeping our head a little bit above water. We weren't in the major crisis situation we are now, despite the economic constraints that government had, particularly at the start of its term. But just a couple of things. One thing Dr. Luke said, and Priscilla said, then followed on from it, was how the A&E has become the only practical way of accessing our health service. That is crazy. Like, I had to go to an A&E last year for a very minor injury because there were no other options. And the one thing that we did put forward in government was this concept of primary care centres. And if primary care centres were to be delivered as were envisaged, that we would have diagnostic capacity in local areas, that we would have x-ray facilities in local areas, that if you did have a minor injury, you would go to your primary care centre, not your local A&E. That hasn't been delivered upon when we have had the means to do that. We do not have enough community capacity in terms of, you know, accessing health when you're sick. That's why people are being funneled to their Bond hospitals and their UHLs, and that's something that just has to end. We need to resource our community care and our community health services properly.
Colin Burke,
can I just come in on the?
I just put this question to you first, and I'll give you an opportunity to come back on that. There are surplus billions in the budget at the moment. There is private hospital capacity. Tadhg Daly from Nursing Homes Ireland says there are hundreds of beds around the country. Chris Luke said it needs to be treated like a COVID-type response. Why has that emergency response not been triggered and the money spent to acquire that capacity and alleviate the suffering that's going on in Irish hospitals at the moment?
Well, I was speaking to a rep from the Private Hospitals Association today, and what they want set out from the HSE is a clear plan. And, you know, we do have a shortage of capacity at the moment. Therefore, we need now to set out a 2 or 3 year plan with the private hospitals at this stage so that we can deliver the level of service for all patients.
But is that not the job of government to get the HSE to do that? I mean, if you have been talking to somebody from the private hospitals, what's the means by getting that activated?
There is nothing preventing it from being activated, but this issue of contacting the private hospitals at the last minute to set up a support mechanism, which is way too late. We need to have a 3 year plan with the private hospitals, right? Because,
but
you know, we talked about
in fairness to Colin, I don't believe that the government are commentators, and Colin can't be a commentator. The Minister for Health is certainly not a commentator. In the winter plan just published, it talked about leveraging more private sector capacity. And we had the Minister for Health on RT in the first week in January saying that he asked the HSE to do more, to be more energetic. Colin was talking about the need for a clear plan. We all knew this was coming. We knew in the summer had a crisis. Here we are in the throes of a crisis in emergency departments, and Colin is still talking about the need for a clear plan.
Let him back in there.
The point I'm making is that we've put in place something like 185 beds from the private hospital sector, but at a very late stage. I am saying now that we need, we've talked about, there's an agreement that 3 elective hospitals need to be built. That'll take,
I know, but Finlay Hay said this was flagged in July. She got zero engagement, according to her. Why wasn't this activated in July?
Having spoken to the private hospital sector, they are prepared to enter into a 2 or 3 year plan with the HSE so that we're not going from week to week and month to month, and they're prepared to do that. And I'm saying to the HSE, and I will be also saying to the Minister, now is the time to put that in place.
No, last summer was the time to do it, Colin, with respect.
I agree totally with you, David, but I am not the person who's taking the decisions on this. I'm the person, the same as you are, who has the same amount of information as a backbencher. Therefore, my job is to highlight the issue and to make...
It's the Minister for Health's responsibility, and it has to be said, he failed. He can't produce a winter plan and then just forget about it.
Have you raised this personally with the Taoiseach?
With the Taoiseach's office, yes, in the last few weeks I have.
And what was the response?
Well, it's been, my understanding is that this is an issue that the Department of Health has to deal with. I will be corresponding with the Taoiseach's office over the next few days, and I will be meeting with someone from the Taoiseach's office as well. The other issue, in relation to the elective hospital issue, the South Infirmary / Victoria University Hospital in Cork is an elective hospital. Its operation hasn't been affected in any way because of this crisis. Right. And this is just highlights why the building of elective hospitals and
you have made that point already, Duncan Smith.
Just on the Nursing Homes Ireland saying they have 1,000 beds, that kind of, I just kind of question that, because first of all, it's a nice round number. But second of all, I know the Nursing Home Ireland and nursing homes have struggled to retain and recruit staff. Like, everywhere else across our health service or our care service. And nursing home staff, such as home care workers then as well, as so-called Section 39 workers, if there's one thing the government can do is follow the Labour Party's call and our private member's motion recently and ensure that they are brought into a process for pay justice and pay restoration.
Sure, well, I suppose we have
that
to
would help recruitment and retention, which is what you're talking about, in terms of actually delivering people through the system into home care or into nursing homes. But I would question that figure of 1,000, that there's 1,000 beds waiting.
I can give you
in
figure.
Nursing homes for people.
Colm, I can give you the figure. They surveyed over 200 nursing homes. 147 nursing homes said they had 760 vacant beds. And remember, there's over 430 nursing homes. About 200 did not reply to the survey.
And they want hospitals to contract those beds and use them as step-down facilities. So why is that not being done? Whether it's 700 or whether it's 1,000 or whether it's 200, why are they not being contracted?
The HSE do have contracts with some of the private nursing homes. They pay for a full 12 months for beds in private nursing homes, and those beds are used up. What the nursing homes are saying to me is that over the last 8 weeks, the nursing homes that I contacted, they've had very little contact from the HSE about increasing that number of beds that would be available should the requirement be there.
All right, okay.
And that's the point I'm making.
Priscilla Lynch.
There's definitely a consistent lack of contact between the HSE and the Private Hospital Association, and also the Nursing Homes Ireland and those beds there. I mean, they operate in silos, and I know during the pandemic they all came together closer together, and we said that this would continue, but this has all fallen by the wayside again. And to be fair to the private hospitals, they're not lying around empty. They have lots of patients. Half the population has private health insurance. There's a lot of elective surgery happening there. Waiting lists would be far worse without it. And they also have high dependency unit beds, so that they do have actually some critically ill patients in there at the time. And then, as we've heard, just turning around last week and saying, well, we want some of your beds. I mean, it just isn't good enough. And also, I know that there are a lot of nursing home beds potentially empty, but is there a mismatch there population-wise in the parts of the country where they may be needed and patients mightn't be able to go to those particular areas? And also, they've had a lot of trouble recruiting staff as well. One nursing home told me they've lost 60% of their nurses since the pandemic because the HSE has managed to hire them on higher, better terms and conditions. So there is it's a bit more complex.
Well, on that recruitment and retention issue, we're an Anglophone country. We're in competition with Australia, Canada, the US. How is that circle squared? How do we retain staff when there are bigger, wealthier health systems like in the likes of the case of the US with serious private providers out to poach Irish trained doctors?
Absolutely. And I mean, if you look at the advertising campaigns around the country and in the medical press from abroad, from those countries looking for our highly skilled doctors and nurses and other healthcare professionals, they are attracting those staff abroad because it's better terms and condition, a better quality of life. Most healthcare staff will tell you it's not generally about the wages. But the healthcare unions themselves, they've told the government why their staff don't want to stay here and what we do need to do. And have they done it? I mean, negotiating new contracts is the most painful thing in the healthcare sector. It drags on for years. And what's been particularly frustrating, even when it comes to implementing new healthcare plans, one key person
will have to go for 6 months because they're ill or they've retired, and suddenly things grind to a halt. That would not be accepted in the private sector. And to be fair to Colm, as he said, some things are handed into one person and they're not handed to the next relevant department for 6 or 7 months. That's completely unacceptable. So we do need to have a much stronger focus on getting those negotiations over the line, getting agreement over the line. And actually, if we could maybe take some radical action, because Canada and Australia and even the UK, to attract healthcare staff to say very rural areas or very over in areas that are in crisis, they can offer kind of these special one-off incentives. Yet we just disengage and say, oh no, we couldn't possibly do that.
David Cornell, I can tell you what the market demands, is it?
Well, I can tell you that there are frontline healthcare workers, be it junior doctors, consultants, nurses, listening to this programme, who will be screaming at the radio saying that we've been talking about these issues for years. You're asking the question, what do we need to do? If you look at junior doctors, they threatened strike action last year because they're working 80 hours a week. They've put on the table what their issues are. They're relocated to different parts of the country without proper supports and allowances. All of those issues have been well known. We haven't dealt with them. The INMO have been talking for years about legislating for safe staffing levels. What Phil Nihay was talking about was the skills mix framework and the safe staffing framework. That is the science that tells us here's the staff
right,
that we need.
What do you do when you're competing with very wealthy health systems or very big private players in other health systems that are willing to pay top dollar beyond even what the top paid consultants
well,
in this
I
country
can tell
are
you,
paid?
I can tell you what I would do if I was the Minister for Health is first of all substantially increase training places so we have more graduates that we can actually attract into the public
system. And
how
do you keep them in the country?
And second of all, we then have to start putting the capacity in, because the one thing that doctors say to me, and Stephen Donnelly talked at the start of this week or last week about consultants and senior decision makers having to be on the floor of emergency departments. And yes, they have to be, but they need the tools to do the job. So they don't have the surgical theatre capacity, the diagnostic capacity, the beds to admit patients.
Right.
They can't do the job
Colin,
that they want to do. So we have to
give
them
the
tools to do it.
I'll come back to you in a minute, I just need to go to Duncan. So how would you retain people in the country?
It's been articulated well by Phil Nihay at the start of the show and by David and Priscilla now in terms of what should be done in terms of recruitment, retention, safe staffing levels. But one thing, and it's prescient today because of what happened in government
buildings.
But
how do you stop them? You called for increased training places. How do you keep them in the country?
You keep them by making a better work environment, by making it a safe work environment.
To you
ensure
need to keep them
well.
In the country to make it a safe work environment. You need more of them to stay to make it a better work environment.
You do need more of them to stay. But also, just one thing that we need to mention here, because there was a big summit conference in government buildings today. We need to make housing affordable, because what we're hearing from healthcare assistants, from nurses, from non-consultant hospital doctors now is they can't afford housing, particularly in Dublin and in our major cities. That is across the board in terms of recruitment retention. Why are bus services being cancelled? Because they can't get bus drivers. Why can't they get bus drivers? Because they can't afford to live.
Right.
That can't go unsaid. That is a really important issue.
Colin Burke, how do you keep them in the country? We had the public-only contract signed with an upper level of about 300,000 plus euro if you include training allowances and the like. And there is still scepticism being expressed by doctors.
Okay, but if you look at the number of consultants in this country has gone up from about 2,500 10 years ago to over 3,800 now. Yes, we need to increase it further, but if we want to increase the number of consultants, we also must increase the availability of services. For instance, I was speaking to one consultant who had returned from the United States to work in a hospital in the Northwest, and she can only get a half day a week for operating time. And if a patient is not into theatre by 4 o'clock in the evening, then that patient is cancelled.
But before we go to our next break, give me one solid suggestion as to how that would be changed.
Because, can I go back on the GP thing? We've increased the number of GP trainees, and only of the numbers that have come out after the four-year training programme for GPs, something like less than 6% have left.
Right, how do you stop that, though? Give me one solid suggestion as to how you stop that.
What you need to make sure is that the support mechanisms are there in the hospitals, that there's no point in appointing a consultant who cannot get access to theatre. For instance, I have a situation where a consultant was appointed over 2 years ago and he still cannot hold clinics because he cannot get the backup support staff to be available with him to hold a clinic. So he's now going to look at, say, well, are there better jobs out there for me? So it's not only about appointing, but also making sure that we have the necessary support mechanisms in place to keep him here.
All right, I want to get to a few listeners' texts. Somebody texting in to say, Sláintecare has become a pipe dream. Somebody else. Sean saying, if only Simon Harris had marched down to the courts and nationalised the private hospitals during COVID and that national emergency. Bernard tweeted in to say, not enough beds. I mean, several question marks after that. Beds in 1980 were at 17,600. Fine Gael government under Garrett Fitzgerald in 1981. There has been a bed cut after bed cut. And another texter, Tina, saying, who's a nurse, saying, what makes a difference for Waterford University Hospital is having Wexford General Model 3 Hospital 35 miles away. Limerick Hospital dealing with a much larger population and has no Model 3 Hospital next door. So that's Tina, a nurse, texting us in on 51551. You can also tweet at latedebate.rte or email us at latedebate@rte.ie. We want to come back and have a look at some of those protests outside of Centres for Asylum Seekers after this.
The Late Debate with Cullum O'Mungon on RTE Radio 1.